D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Und am Mikrofon ist Katrin Ohlendorf. Heute Search and Macro von Peter Diamond. Für diesen Oktober meldete die Bundesagentur für Arbeit 2,74 Millionen Arbeitslose in Deutschland. Gleichzeitig wurden der Agentur eine 500.000 offener Stellen gemeldet. Da stellt sich die Frage, warum finden innerhalb eines Marktes solche, die etwas suchen und solche, die etwas anbieten, in diesem Fall wäre das Arbeit, nicht zueinander? Nach der reinen neoklassischen Marktlehre dürfte das eigentlich nicht passieren. Und genau das ist das Thema unseres heutigen Vortragenden Peter Diamond. Zusammen mit Dale Mortensen und Christopher Pissarides wurde ihm 2010 der Wirtschaftsnobelpreis verliehen, und zwar für die Analyse von Märkten mit sogenannten Suchfriktionen. Suchfriktionen nennt man die Gründe, die dafür verantwortlich sind, dass Marktteilnehmer nicht optimal zueinander finden. Diamond untersuchte schon in den 70er Jahren, wie sogenannte Suchkosten den Markt beeinflussen. Im Falle eines Arbeitssuchenden wären solche Kosten zum Beispiel der Aufwand, den er betreiben muss, um sich zu informieren, oder das Einkommen, das ihm während der Suche entgeht. Diamonds Analysen bildeten die Basis für die Suchtheorie. Mortensen und Pissarides entwickelten das Modell dann weiter und wendeten es auf den Arbeitsmarkt an. Seinen Vortrag über die Suchtheorie, den wir nun hören, hielt Peter Diamond am 24. August dieses Jahres. Er war der erste Redner beim 4. Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträgertreffen in Lindau am Bodensee, und auch bei uns macht er heute den Auftakt. Immer donnerstags senden wir ab sofort Vorträge von diesem Treffen. Hören Sie heute also Search and Macro von Peter Diamond.
When I was a young economist, I thought that methodology was something old people did when they had nothing better to do. Now that it's age appropriate, I want to stress to you the importance of methodology. The particular point I want to pick out is when I was young, I would look at a model and think, is it a good model? Is it a bad model? And I now think that's the wrong way to frame the question, because the same model can be good for one purpose and bad for other purposes. The real question you should ask is, for this question, is this a model that adds to the insight of what we need to address that question, particularly important, obviously, for policy questions, where you're going from, to my mind, if you're doing it right, a number of different theory and empirical models to drawing together a basis for policy inferences. And you do that because the economy is complex, the political process is complex. The essence of a model, in order to be tractable, is it's not reality. It's a simplification of reality. It gets things wrong. If it's not getting things wrong, it's not a model. And the issue is the things that it's getting wrong are those important or unimportant for the particular question you're asking. I say that because I will talk a little bit about the place where the search equilibrium labor market models are more useful and places where they're missing elements that really matter. So the outline is first of all to say a little bit about labor market flows, to give the context for the model, to then switch to the Beveridge curve, which focuses on unemployment and vacancies over a business cycle, and then to talk about issues in macroeconomics generally. So one model that we're all familiar with is the standard market model. Demand, supply, a price clears the market. The trouble with thinking about the labor market or the housing market from that framework is that the markets don't clear in quite the same sense that the standard model has. So at any point in time, in any small area, you have unemployed workers, you have vacancies. Does that mean the market doesn't clear? Well, in the market context, not clearing, you would say, the wage is wrong. The wage is too high or the wage is too low. There isn't, within the context of that model, a different way of talking about what is going on. So just to bring out the magnitudes here, this is data from the U.S. economy. Monthly worker flows, UE is the flow of workers from unemployment to employment, and as you see, based over a two-decade period, a very large fraction of measured unemployed workers have jobs a month later. Interestingly, an almost as large fraction of unemployed workers are out of the labor force, I for inactive, a month later, given the official definition of what it means to be unemployed, which means actively doing something to find a job, not just wishing you had a job. And there's quite a sizable flow directly from out of the labor market, directly into employment, without a measured period of unemployment in between. I emphasize that because you're interviewing people a month apart. It may be somebody started looking for a job, was not interviewed during that period, and then found a job. On the other hand, there's a good deal of direct flows that don't go through looking for a job. Rather, an opportunity finds you, and you say, yes, I guess I will stop hanging out on the shores of Lake Constance and go to work because somebody has just made me an offer I can't refuse. And similarly, there are large flows directly from employment to unemployment and out of the labor force. And one has to think about all of this in order to think about particularly the role of unemployment insurance. And in doing that, the supply-demand price clears the market model doesn't really capture it. One can fit some unemployment into the model, and of course the Lucas Prescott model is very famous for that, but all the unemployment there was movement between different local markets where the wage cleared the market. So there were never people applying for jobs and not getting them. There were people deciding the opportunities were better elsewhere, and that model also had the property that, analogous to the Valrasian auctioneer, there was somebody directing the flows to the right places between markets. So that model, I think, really expanded some of our understanding of fitting some frictions into the Arrow de Bruce setting, but it doesn't come to grips with the kind of issues there. The U.S. has very high labor flows, much higher than any of the other economies, as really shown by this picture. Contrasting, the first slide was really a three-state model, employed, unemployed, inactive. This second slide here is only two, with inflows and outflows to unemployment, without breaking it down more heavily. The U.S. is clearly an outlier. In the U.S., we have some wonderful data referred to by its acronym, the JOLTS data, which is looking at flows from the perspective of the employers, interviewing the employers rather than interviewing the workers. So you interview an employer and you say, how many employed workers do you have now? How many jobs are filled at your place now? And then you come back, and in this case a quarter later, and you say, now how many jobs do you have filled? And what happens when you do that is that if it's gone up, natural to call it job creation. And as you see again over the two decades for which this data has existed, there's a large percentage of job creation from one quarter to the next. If instead what has happened is the number of employed workers has gone down, natural to call that job destruction, and as you can see, there is almost as large a rate of job destruction as there is of job creation. So the change in total employment is the small difference between two large numbers. And if we want to think about various policies or want to think about various positive issues, then it seems to me you've got to focus on the determinants of these big numbers and how they interact to produce the small number, which is the difference between them. Secondly, you can ask the question, how much hiring do you do? Hiring comes in two forms. One is job creation. The other is a worker leaves, maybe voluntarily, maybe looking for a better opportunity, maybe for other reasons, and you replace that worker with another worker. Maybe you dismiss the worker and you've replaced it. So a hire is just on a name basis, who do you have now that you didn't have a quarter before? And as you can see, the hire rate is roughly twice the job creation rate, which gives you another sense of the large amount of flows going on in the economy. And separations is asking the same question, who was here before, who isn't here now? And again, you see the separation rate and the hire rate are two very large numbers, and the change in employment is the small difference between them. And as you can see, the big sources of separation are layoffs and quits. On average, they're about the same size. In the course of the business cycle, there are dramatic differences between them, with layoffs spiking up early in a recession and quits dropping as workers who quit either for a better job or in anticipation of finding a better job recognize that the labor market is going soft and those opportunities won't be there. The sum of the two may not change a whole lot, but that doesn't mean the underlying story isn't telling us something important. Obviously, when layoffs are way up and quits are way down, we've got a problem on the value to firms of hiring work of having workers, and also we have a change in the perception, which is mostly accurate, of workers for their opportunities should they seek additional employment. So the basic partial equilibrium model of the labor market, that is the heart of what this year's, or I guess I can say this year's until October, this year's Nobel Prize was about, was really paying attention to the models that lead us to think about these flows, to think about the process of bringing together workers and jobs. And the technical fix that has made modeling work is the matching function. The matching function, thought about for the economy as a whole, says the change, the amount of hiring happening is a function of the number of unemployed workers and the number of vacancies. Vacancies, again, measured by, it used to be measured by looking at help wanted ads before we had a survey. Now we have a survey that asks firms, do you have a vacancy? And so we can fit an aggregate matching function. It fits pretty well. It fits ballpark as well as the aggregate production function and plays the same kind of role. The function, as far as we can tell, is constant returns to scale, and as work that Chris Pissarides has done with co-authors, summarizing, and a lot of other estimates as well, Cobb Douglas fits fairly well. This doesn't need to be something complex for thinking about the economy as a whole. And let me stress that it's for thinking about the economy as a whole, because if you have a question for which the answer involves looking more closely by industry or by aspects of firms, then the aggregate matching function may not be terribly informative. So one of the items that has gotten a lot of attention is that the matching function has deteriorated. And this particularly came up in the context here of the beverage curve. The beverage curve gives the vacancy rate relative to the unemployment rate, and given the constant returns to scale, we can work in these rates. And what you would expect if the value of workers to firms deteriorates over time, we would see a decline in vacancies, a rise in unemployment, and that's the typical pattern. And what happened in the U.S. economy is vacancy rates started coming back without much change in unemployment. And that led a number of people to say, we have a serious structural problem in the U.S. economy, and the structural problem is something that aggregate demand stimulation, whether monetary or fiscal, does not do well at, and therefore we should be very cautious about stimulating. Inflation is obviously a major concern of central banks, and the mix between how much are we addressing inadequate aggregate demand unemployment and how much are we addressing what might be a structural problem is a critical part of setting monetary policy. Without studying the labor market, you cannot sensibly pursue monetary policy, particularly in the context of the U.S., where the official mandate of the Fed is to pay attention both to employment and inflation. And frankly, it strikes me as shocking that the mandates of so many central banks are only about inflation, and a relief that most of them view their role no different than in the U.S. the Fed views its role, that the extent of concern goes beyond inflation. And that's appropriate because, to begin with, we don't have a well-settled optimal rate of inflation. 2% or a bit under 2% is the typical target. Where did that come from? Well, zero seems like a bad idea. Big numbers we know are a bad idea. So let's pick a nice round small number. But is 2 better than 3? I don't think we have any idea of that. Olivier Blanchard has raised the idea that 4 might be better, not for the microeconomics of the steady state or normal times, let us say, for which inflation helps with things, but for dealing with financial crises, because they will give central banks more room, less likelihood of hitting the zero bound on interest rates. The timing of that suggestion may not have been optimal, but it seems to me absolutely right that there is nothing that says 2% is the right answer, and nothing that says a central bank that sometimes says 2% and sometimes says for the next few years we would be comfortable with 3%. Nothing wrong with that. It might be a good response to circumstances. As long as credibility is preserved, that 2 or that 3 doesn't become double digits or doesn't even become 8 or 9, much less hyperinflation, in terms of the role of the central bank in having inflation not create problems for the economy. Of course, in some circumstances, having inflation may help with things like debt overhang, but how much inflation, I think, is again an area where we don't have a good answer.
Sie sind im D-Radio-Wissen Hörsaal und hören den Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger Peter Diamond mit einem Vortrag über die von ihm mitentwickelte Suchtheorie. Aufgezeichnet wurde dieser Vortrag im August dieses Jahres während der Lindauer Tagung der Wirtschaftspreisträger. Zum 4. Mal kamen dabei in Lindau am Bodensee Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger mit Nachwuchswissenschaftlern ihres Fachs zusammen. Bevor es weitergeht, mit der zweiten Hälfte des Vortrags kurz noch ein paar Worte zum Redner. Peter Arthur Diamond, 1940 in New York geboren, studierte Mathematik an der Yale University und später Wirtschaftswissenschaften am renommierten Massachusetts Institute of Technology, wo er 1963 auch promovierte. Nach einiger Zeit in Berkeley kehrte er 1996 zurück ans MIT, wo er heute als Ökonomieprofessor arbeitet. Ben Bernanke übrigens, der amtierende Fed-Präsident, war in den 70er Jahren ein Schüler Diamonds.
Die Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
So, I think we want to think about this process as the central bank is addressing the economy keeping a steady inflation rate is an important part of planning, looking ahead, writing contracts, etc. And the state of the labor market is important for two reasons. One, the normative reason. A lot of unemployment is bad, bad for the workers, bad for the economy, bad for the workers' families, bad for the future, particularly with long-term unemployed, of the labor market later on, as workers may be losing skills, losing connections, etc. So there's a need for central banks to pay attention for the normative reason. And on the positive side, estimating what will happen with more stimulus depends again on the details of the labor market. So what's happened in the U.S. in this picture is various people, including, to my mind, particularly appallingly, the distinguished economist who is the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, suggesting that the structural problems were so large that central bank stimulus policies were misguided. There have been a number of studies trying to separate out the excess of U.S. unemployment today compared to what it was like before the crisis between inadequate aggregate demand compared to before, and an increase in structural issues. Keep in mind, there are always structural issues. There are always new needs by firms for skills of workers that some workers have, some workers don't have. And the ability to hire workers who fit in well, who don't need more training, that varies over the business cycle. Obviously, firms are eager for workers that they feel better about and have to train less. At MIT, when we hire an assistant professor, we're very pleased with the ones we hire, but that doesn't stop us from wishing they were the young Paul Samuelson. The issue here, from the perspective of thinking about monetary policy, is what has changed. And I've looked through a lot of these studies, and none of them have an adequate basis of really pinning down a number. The ones I've looked at most closely seem to me to give structural elements a larger role than the seems appropriate based on the theoretical perspective. So insofar as you're looking at what unemployment insurance does to workers' willingness to take jobs, by reading off historic data on the connection between job-finding hazards and unemployment, is ignoring the fact of the matching function at a time when you have a lot of unemployment. Just going off that is basically saying employment equals labor supply in the current climate with high unemployment. That's not going to give you a good estimate. An interesting recent estimate by Bar-Levy focused on the aggregate matching function. In both cases, they turn up that the majority of our excess unemployment is inadequate aggregate demand. And I'm suggesting it's even too high. And part of the issue is if you think about disaggregating the aggregate matching function, which is a very handy tool for theorists and a good starting place for empirical work, you recognize, as the work of Davis and Haltewanger and a series of co-authors have been identifying, that the matching process is very different in different sectors, in different size firms, in rapidly growing firms who may be doing multiple hiring and slow growing firms that are doing less hiring. And so part of what has happened in the U.S., part of what is behind that picture there, is that construction is a place where jobs are filled very quickly. Construction has, employment has collapsed enormously from the overbuilding stage, both residential and commercial construction. And it's because of the overhang of excessive building. It's not coming back quickly, so that in part will be a sustained structural problem because the level of employment there won't go back to its previous level, and there is the frictional element of moving people elsewhere. In contrast, the sectors in the U.S. that have done particularly well, education and health, are dominated by large firms and hire very slowly. As I'm sure you're all aware, the assistant professor market in the U.S. starts with posting a vacancy a year ahead of when anyone will actually get to work. So when you're collecting vacancy statistics, do you have a vacancy? A great fraction of hiring happens without a measured vacancy. Without a measured vacancy. Again, as my previous example talking at the work apart, a lot of that is a posted vacancy. It's filled. That's happened between interviews. You know you've got an extra worker. You miss the measurement of the vacancy. So it looks like it's happening very efficiently, and it is. But the point is, when you disaggregate, you have to say, from the perspective of what's going on here, how much of this is due to the fact that the sectoral mix has changed, that the employer size has changed. Small business is doing particularly badly because small banks are doing badly and are not lending as much, because a lot of small business depends on own wealth, and a lot of that has been in housing and is now gone. And small business hires, fills vacancies much more quickly than large business does, where there'll be a group who monitors the whole hiring process and goes through a series of steps. So there's a whole set of issues. Before you draw inferences about macro, that you really want to do two things. Make sure you're not using a partial equilibrium model for a general equilibrium question. And secondly, working at the right level of disaggregation to inform the question you're interested in. So let me just say a little bit here about macro and the problems of getting the same kind of dynamics that I think, and I guess the prize committee thinks as well, we have made a lot of progress in terms of the labor market. There's a big literature on the housing market. I think that's a harder problem because of the much larger role of finance in house purchases. So there is an informative, interesting literature there as well. And thinking about the economy as a whole. So what's been happening lately is the search labor market model is being embedded in a model that otherwise has a standard market clearing output market, and often one where there's no particular role for short-term finances. So if you have an infinite horizon budget constraint for a representative agent, then you're missing all of one of the pieces Keynes talked about, which is the importance of current income for current spending. And indeed, disaggregated studies show there are a lot of people who are liquidity constrained. There's a lot of empirical link between income and spending on the part of a large fraction, but certainly by no means all, of the consumers in the economy. What do we mean? So the two pillars of the kind of Keynesian analysis I was taught as a student are sticky wages and prices, and the important role of income and so employment feeding back into aggregate demand. So if you're thinking about unemployment insurance and you have no role for unemployment insurance as a built-in stabilizer, you're leaving out a major part of the story. You can provide good insight into part of the story, but it would be wrong to draw policy inferences from just that part without paying attention to the other parts. So sticky wages and prices, there is an ongoing effort to move away from assuming that all the negotiations are successful, that recognize, particularly if you have multiple employees, that there are issues on how you pay new hires relative to how you pay current workers, and issues about how you want to pay current workers. So there's a sticky wage problem there. Sticky prices looks like it's not the same thing, but there is a related issue, which is that firms have financial constraints. They're going to do their pricing. If they could cut the prices enough to sell a lot more but not be able to pay off their debts or their workers. It's not going to help. So there is the issue here of the dynamic process in the output market, which I'm not aware that we have good pricing. I think we need to have income and demand come into it. We need to recognize that markets are incomplete, that many people don't have a complex conditional plan on circumstances going forward, but looks good today and we'll figure out tomorrow. That's missing, by and large, in our models. And so bankruptcy has played very little role in general equilibrium analyses, and yet it's obviously an important part, particularly when you move to the macro dimension. If markets were incomplete and people were never allowed to have a positive probability of bankruptcy, we would have a disastrously bad economy. Allowing people to go bankrupt opens up, as it were, a richer set of assets. We could have pairwise negotiation that worked out all those alternatives without bankruptcy law, but first of all, that would be expensive on an individual, each contract basis trying to figure it out. And secondly, we have the dynamic problem that even small businesses are owing money to lots of different people, the people they borrow from, their suppliers, their workers, etc. So we need some process for dealing with the interactions that come from the fact that, unlike the Arrow-DeBrew model, trading plans are made sequentially with uncertainty about what opportunities you'll have in the future. And so expectation formation and the magic word confidence as a reduced form for expectation formation plays an important role. If we're going to build on search to get a better handle on macro, and I'd like to think, well, that would be a good way, one of several, to be trying to get a better handle on macro, then I think we need to move beyond the partial equilibrium and do much more general equilibrium thinking, which is going to be inherently more difficult because of the additional complexities. But the advantage of being young is you look at things that people have been staring at for years and have run out of ideas on, and you have new ideas. And apart from the pay, I'd love to be a young economist again. And I wish you well in helping our profession and our economies go forward. Thank you.
Sie hörten den Nobelpreisträger für Wirtschaftswissenschaften Peter Diamond mit seinem Vortrag Search and Macro über die von ihm mitentwickelte Suchtheorie. Aufgezeichnet wurde dieser Vortrag im August dieses Jahres während der 4. Lindauer Tagung der Wirtschaftspreisträger, beziehungsweise korrekter, der 4. Tagung der Preisträger des Wirtschaftswissenschaftlichen Preises der Schwedischen Reichsbank in Gedenken an Alfred Nobel.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.